language says that we're recording. So, as usual, I'll start out this interview stating that I'm in Helotes, Texas, interviewing Helotes.
Helotes.
H-E-L-O-T-E-S, Texas, interviewing Professor James Augustus McCluskey. It is the 19th of March, and we are at his residence, which is a very pleasant place in the countryside here. And so I think with that, we can go ahead and get started. It's just for informational purposes, the town is in the northwest quadrant of San Antonio's super suburbs. It's really probably not a suburb, it's just a small town outside of the northwest greater San Antonio area. So James, I usually like to start beginning in the childhood.
Start at the beginning?
Yeah, right, start at the beginning. And the influence of your parents and other people in your getting directed towards a scientific career. So tell me a little bit about your parents.
I never met, as far as I know, my father. I was raised by my mother.
He was killed when I was 4.
Oh, no.
Or so. He was killed in World War II. Mm-hmm. Yikes. So I was born here, and as a consequence of being in a military family, he was a physician in the medical corps, it was then called the medical corps, and we moved with him to the Philippines, and we were there a year and a half or something. I can find out. And
so that was while he was alive and he was in the service?
That's right.
Okay.
So that was like 1938 and 9 or something. The war broke out in, what, 41?
Yeah.
And we came back on the last transportation out of the Philippines.
I see. Well, you see, he was in the medical corps, so, I mean, he wouldn't have normally been in a position to be killed in the military, or was he in a dangerous?
Well, I don't know. He was on Bataan. I think.
Oh, okay.
I think by virtue of being there, the risk factor is high.
Yeah.
And so forth. So he died, and I was raised by not only by my mother, as sort of a single parent, but my grandparents as well, and she lived with them off and on.
Okay.
Of time.
What were their names?
My grandmother, that grandmother, these were her parents, not his. Her parents were Archibald Kaler, K-O-E-H-L-E-R, and Catherine.
Florence.
Okay.
Catherine William McCluskey.
Sorry, Florence.
Okay.
Is that right?
Archibald and Florence.
So, anyhow,
we
spent a lot of time in San Antonio, and no time anywhere else. When I was in, right before we went to the Philippines, however, we stayed 6 months at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And the significance of that was that they had a polio outbreak, and I contracted polio almost surely at that time. When we left and went to the Philippines, I was the only person within a large radius that had polio, even though it was the thing around here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they figured that it was corresponded precisely to a outbreak that they had at Fort Sill.
Mm.
Anyway, it didn't affect my legs at all. That was a blissful thing.
Mm, yeah.
It affected the muscle in my right muscle, called the seventh nerve, really, over on the side of my mouth.
Was that an unusual effect of polio? Most of the time, people had leg issues, it seemed.
Not unusual. Okay. I mean, it's not common, but less than. Now, you have people who lose arm control and so forth. The famous ones are the ones who can't walk and so forth. I mean, they're still alive. There's a high mortality rate.
So anyway,
what about your parents' names? We got your grandparents.
My father was James.
Oh, okay.
And I was Robert, to start with. I was born Robert.
Mm-hmm.
And I became James Jr. after he was killed.
Okay.
And it was clear that I was going to be an only child.
And my
mother said, well, let's get straight here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's change your name. And got a court order to do this. And so on. And
so if we go back and look at the records, we'll see Robert on a birth certificate.
Robert on a birth certificate in San Antonio. And I don't remember the year. Maybe I was 5 or 6 years old when it was switched James. So that started the ball rolling. And I lived here, I guess, sort of continuously until I went to graduate school in 1957. So my father was killed in March of 42. That's right. So they named the hospital after him.
Oh, okay.
In Temple, Texas.
Hmm.
Which they didn't change the name after the war. It became a veterans hospital. He was the first doctor to be killed in the war.
Hmm. That's why I was kind of, but like you said, he was in a very bad place.
Yeah, he was the first doctor, so it was one of those strange things, claim to fame. It was kind of crazy. So, anyway, all I had as a youngster growing up was the continuous question from family. Of course, you're going to be a doctor, aren't you? So the automatic reply was no. And it probably changed my... I may have done that, and I might have kind of had a different life path, and I never really, you know. And my mother supported me on that and so forth. So I went to high school here. Excuse me, I went to college here, lived at home, and went to college here.
So your undergraduate was at?
At Trinity University.
Okay.
And so that's kind of a home environment, isn't it? All the way through high school and college at home, living at home.
So your dad was obviously pretty well educated as a physician. Was he just, I guess at that time, and they didn't specialize too much, he was probably like a general practice?
I think so.
Yeah.
He was trained at St. Edward's University in Austin.
Mm.
And of course at that time never dreamed that he would either be in the army or killed.
Yeah.
So
was he taking... because of his skills, or did he volunteer, do you recall, or did you know anything about that part of the...
I don't know, nothing.
Somehow he ended up in the army.
He was willingly part of the thing and so forth, so. I guess what I would need, but don't have, is the year that he entered the military.
Mm-hmm.
All the records, including the details of his death, were destroyed in a fire in St. Louis.
In St. Louis, in the record center.
I don't know when it was. 59 or something.
We remember the fire. I live in the St. Louis area, and that was a very big news splash to have the fire at the record center, and to have so many records destroyed, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah.
So there's no way of knowing.
There are big holes, I think, in the history of the military, and especially the medical corps.
Yeah. Which,
anyhow, that's where it all started, and I went then to college with no real influence from anybody, except there was always an expectation that I would go to school and get educated.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it was a doctor or not wasn't a serious issue, although I found out as I was going through college that two things. One was that I enjoyed chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was that I found out that people who had BS degrees in chemistry were destined for a life of nothing, pretty much. There's nowhere to move, and so forth. Vibes were bad. So that motivated me after college to go to graduate school. And I applied to several places.
Do you recall if there was anyone in your college career that kind of really impress you with chemistry? I mean, a lot of times the teacher or whatnot will get somebody turned on, and or was it just that you found it to be fun?
No, there were two people. There was a man named William McGavock.
How do you spell that one?
McGavock or C-K.
C-K.
And another one named Smith. Let's see, what was his first name?
Well, you know, that's...
They're both chemistry professors.
Uh-huh.
This is a small school.
Mm-hmm.
You've got six chemists graduating with you.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it's not like... anyhow, that... they were influential, and they encouraged me greatly to go on.
Okay, so that was a factor in
chemistry. Yeah, it was quite clear. And
was the rest of your family beginning to back off on the medical degree thing, or were they still?
No, they said, "Well, okay, it's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
You can do what you want to do."
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I was pointed in upward sort of direction.
Yeah, right.
They said, "Well, that's fine." And so there was disappointment in my father's family.
Uh-huh.
That I didn't go into medicine, and furthermore, I changed my name.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But it shouldn't have been a difficulty over that, because I took my father's name, so I think that wasn't that wasn't a problem. So anyhow, time went on, and I went to Trinity. Graduated from Trinity in 4 years, very standard arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And
all things like what the tuition was and how you were financed.
I had trouble. No, there was trouble here because my mother never remarried, and her income was confined largely to military pension type stuff for widows.
Yeah.
Now. In those days, however, being a widow meant that you not only had medical care, but and especially if your father, if your husband had been a doctor who was killed,
mm-hmm.
at cemented it in, and I had medical care.
Mm-hmm.
This is great, you know, you get an orthodontist to look at your
disease,
and it goes on like that. So that was helpful. I had some scholarships, at Trinity, which was helpful, and I worked in the summers somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The one I remember the most was a place called American Lithium Chemicals.
Oh, wow.
Incorporated outside of San Antonio. And I was in there just doing lab work part-time. I mean, just scut work.
Mm-hmm.
But that suited me.
Mm-hmm.
And a significant amount of money, I think, over a period of time. So
your tuition was in the range of...
I don't know what it was in those days, but it was relatively high, and still is. It was a private university.
For a private school.
It has some affiliation with the Presbyterian Church, but mm-hmm. not much.
Mm-hmm.
And their academic rating is now notably higher after I left. It's pretty good. In fact, it's pretty good. So...
I don't think that you're leaving.
There wasn't a relation to this trip, but that's a beautiful campus.
Mm-hmm.
It's here in the city.
Is it still a pretty small school compared to...
Well, they've got maybe 2,500 students. Okay. That's pretty small.
Yeah, by today's standards.
Yeah. Anyhow, that was the story there. And I found out that I could also get financial support as the son of a survivorship thing in it or not, but because of my father and his death and so forth, I had a small stipend that got cranked up and paid me through graduate school.
Oh, wow.
So I got a little bit there.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking $100 a month or $200 mm-hmm. a month. I don't remember, frankly. And you add that to normal support the graduate students get.
Yeah, sure.
You work in the lab and they pay you something. Maybe it's thesis work, maybe it's not,
mm-hmm.
but everybody contributes. And
yeah.
and so forth. And, so that was the, those were the parameters up to that stage.
So you were able to go to school, not, you weren't living high off the hog, so to speak, but you were...
It was fairly fundamental, and I enjoyed it, except that I found out that there was a sea change, S-E-A change, in culture and everything around me, moving from here to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Mm.
This was a big change.
Oh, yeah.
in every way you can think of it.
So this was graduate school?
Graduate school.
What made you decide to try to get into MIT?
Well, there were several options. I've also applied to Purdue, which is red hot. Mm-hmm. Place at that time. And I liked analytical chemistry, and that seemed to be interesting. So,
mm-hmm.
So those are the two places I was accepted to, Purdue, and then was accepted at MIT. And I was always impressed by the fact that the chairman of the Department of Chemistry at Purdue wrote me a nice letter saying, you know, best of luck.
Hmm.
Sorry you won't join us.
Yeah.
But just good luck in your future endeavors.
What year would this have been?
That would have been 53.
57.
No, wait a minute.
57.
53, graduated from high school.
57, graduated from college.
57, graduated from college. And so all the wheels also were turning slightly early. I was 16 when I graduated from high school.
Mm.
And even in that point, I look back and see that I had been 16 that 16 thing was only for about a month. So I really was younger than that.
Mm.
And it was because my mother decided that the public school system wasn't good enough, and I was going to Catholic schools.
No.
And they were really advanced.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just slip over to the sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it.
So you skipped a grade?
Skipped a grade, and that put me on a different track for mm-hmm. a long time. Interesting how those tracks work out.
Oh, yeah.
And so I finished graduate school.
I'm just curious if you know the name, remember the name of that Catholic school.
Which one? That I went to?
Yeah, the one you went to.
Oh, my gosh. No, I don't. When I was a little tad, a little guy, I went to St. Peter's Prince of the Apostles school somewhere. And then when I was later, Mount Sacred Heart. Mount, because I remember because of the uniform. Patch on the sleeve.
So you were in a uniform type outfit.
This place was run by nuns.
Yeah. Yep, everybody chuckles on that one.
Boy, I saw some real human rights violations. You towed the line, and so forth. And so.
Well, it didn't hurt you any.
No, I came away, at least at that time, with a fairly good handwriting, which is one of the things you caught. They made sure you could do this.
Yeah.
So anyhow, then on to graduate
school. You were really pushing it age-wise in terms of...
a little bit.
You were kind of at the youngest in your classes as you were progressing now at this point in time.
Yeah.
Did you see that as a handicap, or did it work out okay? Or
I never thought about it. It didn't seem to be a handicap. After a while, I figured out it may have been an advantage of some kind, but I never could figure out how I was going to take advantage of that. But it meant that I was, 21 when I got a PhD or something. Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe earlier. I did 16 plus 4. 20, I guess, I got a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, high school.
No, that was, yeah.
Sorry.
We had our first date on your transfer. That was before you went to MIT.
That's right. About that. Anyhow. So that was the track. And my mother, anyhow, died in 1988. And so forth. So, but I was raised essentially by her.
Okay.
One parent thing. I did have grandparents, but they their influence in a parental sense was pretty minimal.
Mm-hmm.
Sit down, let's talk about this. It wasn't any of that. So I think I was run in a one-parent family, actually.
Yeah.
And she worked very hard to, you know, says I couldn't marry anybody else, I couldn't do anything else because of your father and so on.
And did she actually have a job in addition to the pension, or was she able to?
She did not.
Mm-hmm.
She did not, and I think that's what made life more difficult for her. And of course, this is in an era right then, this is in the 1940s, where women didn't go out and work. I mean, they were either housewives or something.
Yeah.
They went to work for the war effort or something. But you know, you didn't have skills that were natural for you to take advantage of. So anyhow, I somehow made it through MIT.
So it was
relatively difficult because of a different level of education.
Mm-hmm.
Just is nothing like I was accustomed to.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was at Trinity, I found out that some of the courses I was taking, were boring.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't do very well, and I found out it was because I was bored. But when I went to MIT, all that stopped. Because you're running on a treadmill night and day.
Yeah.
To keep up.
Yeah, it's a high
performance story. And you're, of course, also in the presence of the MIT undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very smart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very smart. Smarter than the graduate students.
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting experience. The whole
thing. What year did you start at MIT then? That would have been somewhere
57,
in
and I had gone back up one step. I had gone through ROTC in college, also in high school, I think, by my
age. Was this Army ROTC?
Army ROTC, yeah. And I did it in college.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I graduated as a second lieutenant in the reserves from college, I accrued an obligation at that point. And the choices were, you can pick when you go in, but you've got either 6 months or 2 years service. And the 6 months is saying you get very little choice, and then it's saying the 2 years you get a little more choice, and so on. So I said, you know, I found out that one of the most awful prospects would be for, because I'd talked to people who had done this, is to get a PhD from a school like MIT and then go in the Army. I was an artillery officer, and I thought, they said, gee, and I said, whoa. So I said, okay, I've got to get out of this deal. So I talked to the people at MIT to take a leave.
Mm-hmm.
And get rid of the military service and return.
Okay.
He said, oh, that's wonderful. There's no problem. Just let us know when you're ready to come back. Very informal arrangement.
So this was you opted for the 6 months?
No, at that time I opted for the 2 years.
Oh, okay.
And because I got transferred to the Chemical Corps, that was helpful. I think it was helpful.
Yeah.
So I did so by actually going to the Pentagon. I went to the Pentagon, big building, and I walked in the front door and found the chemical career officer. He's the guy that guides people, officers in the chemical career.
Mm-hmm.
And I knocked on his door, and as a result of this, we chatted and had tea and other things. he said, you know, let me know exactly what your timetable is, and I think I can get you out of the artillery.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved out of artillery into the Chemical Corps. And while I didn't, the result of that actually was that I spent, the 2 years was spent mostly in a lab.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know what to do with me. This was at the biological warfare place in Fort Detrick.
Yeah.
And they weren't sure. There were chemists there and so on and so on. But they weren't quite sure what to do with me, so they pretty much said, "Here's a lab. Go get them."
Yeah.
So that was that was the thing. I published my first paper out of working there. I dreamed up something to do and did it and finished it and published it, and I was happy. So that was that, and went back to MIT.
So it was a little 2-year hiatus.
Hiatus, and I had done pretty much my coursework before I left. And then when I get back, then there was exams you have to take to get into candidacy. That was, that was awful. That was awful. I mean, that's these are big barriers in life. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And so I came back, and
you had
I was married while I was gone, which I was married when I was in the Army.
Okay.
So the difference was, of course, another difference was when I returned to graduate school, I was married. When I left graduate school, I was not married.
Yeah.
So life is somewhat different there, and both of us were adjusting to New England. The weather, the language, you name it. It just was another.
So your wife is in this area?
She's from the Gulf Coast.
Oh, okay. So both southern type.
That's right. That's right.
Not used to the upper northeastern.
No, no, no. Northeastern. But we enjoyed it. We both thought that Cambridge and Boston was a worthwhile experience. For anybody, I recommend it. It's full of all kinds of cultural things that you're not familiar with, right? Music, art, different points of view, people from all over the place. If you go to a big-time graduate school, you meet people from all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, they just... And that's a plus in my book. That is a serious plus. You don't know it at the time, but later on you say, gosh, that was a very positive thing. And it influences me later in life. Even I realize that my acceptance of diversity and so forth was partly because I was tossed into this maelstrom of different people and ideas and cultures and so forth. So then, let's
see. You finally got through with your Army obligation. Now you have to go back to MIT, and you're you have to somewhere in there. You have to decide who you're going to work for.
That's right. And they it was analytical chemistry, and it turned out that at that time, there were analytical chemistry division had three professors, and unknown to me, one of them had just gotten a job at Purdue to move. He was a full professor to move to Purdue. I didn't really know that when I went to talk to him. And then another one was an electrochemist. He was okay, I thought. And then the third was a totally untested, brand new assistant professor, Klaus Beeman, who worked with mass spectrometry, which I didn't know anything about. And Dr. Rogers said, Buck was his nickname, Buck Rogers, said, "You know, you really should go down." I walked in to tell him I was going to work with him. He said, "No, no, no, you really should go down and talk to Klaus Beeman. You know, he can measure N15 contents of amino acids in mixtures." All kinds of things that sounded a little on the edge, you know. He said, "That's pretty exciting, you should do that." And I went down the hall and never came back.
Now this Dr. Rogers guy, what's the weather here? How does he fit into the...
Well, he then moved. So
he was the guy who was going to Purdue?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So he kind of...
moved to Purdue.
He kind of didn't want to take anybody on because he knew he was better.
Yeah, he's walking out the door. I didn't know that,
yeah.
See? But he was very warm in his endorsement of Klaus Beeman.
Yeah, so I still need to... So we figured this is in the early 60s. He spent 2 years with your Army obligation.
This is 59.
No, we married in 60.
sorry, this is 60.
But he was born in 62.
I graduated from graduate school in 63. It was 2 years, so I went back in 61. It must have been 61 back to school, 2 years, graduated then, in 63.
So Klaus hadn't been there, he'd been there maybe
2 years.
Not too many, not too long.
But the interesting thing about it was that even at my early stage in life, I could read the jungle drums. Mm-hmm. And the jungle drums were, be very careful if you go to work for an untenured assistant professor in this place, because they don't get tenure.
Uh-huh.
And where are you?
Yeah.
You are out, yeah. High and dry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, he had no graduate students.
At that time, he was.
And so they're saying, whoa, this is a limb.
You were his first experiment.
Yeah. And I said, okay, I want to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. So I did it. And I remember going back to see him after he had interviewed me and gone back. And I said, I want to work with you. Looks kind of amazed at this. He said, sure, you want to work with me? Mm-hmm. I said, yes. So that was for him a big deal, because being an assistant professor, you don't get anything done without hands. You need hands.
Yeah.
And in his case, the hands were from graduate students, which then rapidly followed. He wrote this book, and that gave him an element of fame called Photometry. Yeah. So he began with the students, but he understood what to do, and it was to import, in this case, Austrian, Swiss and Austrian postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come in ready to go,
mm-hmm.
no training,
mm-hmm.
and no mass spectrometry. That's not important. They do chemistry things.
Yeah.
But they went into mass spectrometry pretty fast, because it was being learned at that time that mass spectrometry was chemistry. These were gas phase reactions of organic molecules. There were rules. Nobody understood them too well, but there were rules, and it was a new day.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, because my recollection is that he really had this chemical synthesis route to make these compounds he wanted to study that weren't really amenable to mass spec volatile, so he would derivatize the things to get them in the volatile form. But his earlier training was in all this chemistry technology.
Yeah. So he was really a microchemist.
Yeah.
He worked for this man named Brett Schneider, and was a microchemist with peptide
mm-hmm.
and had got him. He saw the problems, and he saw, you know, this is a different sort of game. And he sold me on the idea, initially, that the enemy here is volatility. We are really up against it,
mm-hmm.
because we're now making these derivatives to do GC with and
mm-hmm.
so forth. And wow, there must be a better way to do this. And the better way is to try and find a more direct route to making gaseous ions, especially of biological molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, and I got into, that's where I got into the nucleoside, nucleic acid
mm-hmm.
arm of things, because mm-hmm. they were terrible. It was the worst case.
Yeah.
They're more polar than peptides, and it was horrifying. So,
but I mean, my recollection was Klaus was focused on peptide work initially.
That's
so,
right, for a long time, even while I was there.
Yeah.
The peptide thing went on full.
But so why did you get, did you select a nucleotide side of things, or did he suggest that, or how did you get into that?
No, I thought it looked very interesting, and the biochemistry seemed to be endless.
Oh, yeah.
And other, it was more endless than I knew.
But for mass spec, they're more difficult to deal with.
That's right. So this was an opportunity.
Okay.
He said, let's start by, there is a mass spectrometer that is on the market that we can buy, and he was trying to get money from NASA at that time
mm-hmm.
to do it, which is a Bendix time of flight mass spectrometer.
Oh, yeah.
And it has a probe that comes in from the mm-hmm. bottom like this, and mm-hmm. they did inorganic thermal things with it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he reflected that he had met or heard of a man in Scotland named Reed, Ivor Reed,
mm-hmm.
who had some success with some polar molecules, putting them on the end of a probe like that and putting them in and just flashing them off
mm-hmm.
some mass spectrometer. And he said, that's an interesting thought. Because they would be subliming them. They would be sublimed, in other words,
mm-hmm.
if they didn't decompose.
Mm-hmm.
So let's try that. And that worked, and it was gold.
So this was... one of the things I've been trying to sort out, personally, is who really is the responsible entity for the creation of the direct insertion probe for putting samples into the mass spectrometer. Sounds like, I'm getting the sense that Bendix was the one that pioneered this.
Well, they pioneered it, but not for organic molecules.
No, not for organic molecules.
They had a device you could use. And so since I made it work, and then Klaus had just gotten a 21, CBC 21,
103.
And said we should be able to do the same thing.
So what does he have? Well, but when you first came there, he was already doing mass spec, so what was he using?
That must have been with his 103.
With 103, okay.
And that's the bottom row.
The 110 is the...
CBC 21-110.
Okay, yeah, that's the big Matau-Kurzog puppy.
Yeah, that's right. So he was working in the Stone Age.
Yeah, so he was trying to get money for...
And he did. He got it for NASA. And so I was kind of on a parallel track.
NSF. It's
funded
by NSF.
By NSF. Oh, okay.
NSA?
NSF.
NSF. Okay.
That's what
the 110.
At that time, he had also Al Burlingame, then joined his group after I did. And he worked on alkaloids. So he also had a track that was destined to not be the mainstream of Klaus's work. Although Klaus really enjoyed the alkaloid work.
Yeah.
It worked well for him. And it was
they didn't have to do so much messing around with the derivatization and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and you get families of reactions. You can place substituents by the shift technique.
Yeah.
The shift technique was a gem for the shift technique.
So that shift technique does what?
It means that you take the mass spectrum of a simple model and you understand it.
Uh-huh.
Now you look at its neighbors or its homologs and analogs. You see some peaks stay the same and some shift.
Oh, okay.
If they shift by 14 Daltons, you have a methyl group, and so on and so on.
Uh-huh.
While that doesn't give you total structure, it's
very easy to know what's going on.
Amount of information.
Uh-huh.
And these guys spent years with alkaloid things. Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
They were being used for cancer. Vinblastine and vinclistine and these things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good line for Klaus, and he wrote it for a while.
Yeah.
And then realized, I think, that it was its time had come and gone.
So did Al come after you were there about the same time, Al Burlingame?
No, after I was... let's see. I don't think he was there when I came back from the Army.
So he would have been an earlier...
But a little later.
A little later.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I joined Klaus's group first.
Mm-hmm.
He was second, but he graduated before I did.
Ah, okay.
So he's the earliest product
mm-hmm.
on the PhD list and so forth.
So, where are we? You decided to go into the...
So that was the days when we were doing direct probe mm-hmm. analysis, and we could get spectra of compounds, including amino acids. We got the first mass spectra of three amino acids, and the first mass spectra of underribitized carbohydrates, and all this is lost in the fog of history. And we published a paper in Chemistry and Industry, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
About the fact you could do these, you could measure mm-hmm. spectra. But, of course, there's still limits. Nucleotides were still out of the question.
Yeah.
You had phosphate, and you just put a barrier around yourself. And if you made oligonucleotides where there were a series of nucleosides connected by phosphate bridges, the polarity didn't get worse.
Mm-hmm.
So even after a while of that, and then, well, let me say, I spent a lot of time trying to understand the mass spectra of simple nucleosides, and we spent a lot of time doing that.
So these were, you just take the simplest ones that you could come up with, and they were fairly easy to get spectra from.
So easy to get spectra from
the simple
ones. And you could then find out how to get labels in.
Oh, okay. So
there was a chemistry already out there,
uh-huh.
and you could get deuterium in.
Okay.
And you could find out ways to get N15 in, or buy something that had N15 in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a route to take to understand. Still, it was the problem that they're polar.
Mm.
And when you have a mixture of these things, life is terrible.
Yeah.
Just like the peptide people were finding, that you can take a large protein, make peptides out of it enzymatically.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those guys are very polar, and you still have to separate them and so on and so on. So that one thing leads to another, and you see the necessity for improvements in the methodology that is led by those facts.
Yeah, if you didn't have to make gas phase ions out of samples, then mass spec would be a...
I'd be selling shoes or
yeah.
maybe life insurance.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's right.
So you were still, all this time, you were using electron
ionization. That's right.
There was no, you hadn't gotten into the other ionization.
CI program. Came along just at the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
If we're trying to categorize this. And of course, if you look at the history, the real history of mass spectrometry, organic mass spectrometry, it rides on the back of volatility.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was controlled by volatility, and its history and what people did, chemical ionization and field ionization and field desorption, and then electrospray. And it went on and on. And those were all invented and used and exploited because of the volatility problem.
Mm-hmm.
That was the fundamental
mm-hmm.
backbone of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because so many papers have been published on variations of those things, and mm-hmm. many of them are not very good.
Mm-hmm.
But they were steps forward.
You yeah.
said, well, look. 2 years ago, we couldn't do anything, so
yeah.
give me a break.
Yeah. Well, looking back on it, when you've got modern techniques at your fingertips, then, you know, it looks like a minor
yeah.
advance. But
yeah.
at the time,
yeah.
it was an important step in the right direction.
That's right. And I remember riding in a taxi in Baltimore, it was, with a fellow named Alan Wolstenholme.
Yeah.
Who was a salesman for, who was it, BG?
Well, at the AEI time it was probably Kratos or AEI, probably AEI back then.
And he told me, he said, Jim, let me tell you about this. I just came back from England, and I have to tell you this. There's a method where you can make polar things fly
mm-hmm.
very easily
mm-hmm.
by mixing them with glycerol,
mm-hmm.
and then you shoot it with a beam of something.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, you know, that sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it exploded after that. It was the thing.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, the first look that understanding that people had that there is numberless, limitless possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get into that sort of thing, the world mm-hmm. is going to get rosier than you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was before you could even connect a chromatograph of any kind.
Right.
And that led to another big branch of the tree, right? And so forth and so on.
Yeah, well, the one you're talking about, of course, is fast adam bombardment.
Yeah, it's yeah. fast adam bombardment.
Yeah. So, were you going to, they were ASTM meetings then? At that time, there were
ASTM meetings, E14, Committee E14.
Yeah.
And I was going to those. I went. The first one I went to was in New Orleans. Klaus told me about this and said, why don't you go to this?
Yeah.
See what's going on.
Yeah.
And I went to this and I found out that there was a world of oil chemists.
Yeah.
I don't mean fats and oils.
Oil in the ground.
Oil in the ground chemists. Who did a lot of mass spectrometry.
Oh, yeah.
All kinds.
Oh, yeah.
And they didn't worry about funds or anything. It was very impressive. But the chemistry was sort of limited in a certain sense. So if you get people looking at hardcore chemistry issues, and that was Joe Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
And then Frank Field, and
uh-huh.
so forth.
Uh-huh.
Burnaby Munson.
Yeah.
And that.
Did it strike you as strange that these guys worked for petroleum companies at the time?
Yeah, I did a little bit. And then I began to realize that they went where the problems are.
Mm-hmm.
And where the problems are, the money is. And the oil people have just nothing but cash flowing out of holes in the ground. You want two mass spectrometers? In academia, you're lucky if you get one in your lifetime.
Yeah.
And these guys had two and three
lined
up on the floor.
Yeah.
And that was pretty impressive. So you realize that there was a dynamic here
mm-hmm.
that one had to pay attention to.
Yeah, well, that was my earliest recollections of those meetings were pretty much similar. So the oil people, you know, kind of dominated things. But there were always this group. Those are like fundamentals, people doing fundamentals, and
that's right.
Say Franklin and Field and Munson.
Of course, even the fundamentals were pretty fundamental in the sense that they're worried about bond strengths and
mm-hmm.
simple stuff in ethane and
propane
and so on.
Yeah, in hydrocarbon molecules.
So, but you know, that's where you begin, and of course that was, I have to look at the date.
Well, New Orleans, I can get the date for that, because I have all those dates. I was in the ancient history kind of, I think that was the last meeting they had in New Orleans. That was one of the earlier,
only one, you think?
Well, they had two in New Orleans, and that was, I think it might have been the second of the two, and they had a problem with one of their attendees couldn't get a hotel room or whatever, you know, because he was black. And,
oh, Lord.
They didn't, they opted not to go back to New Orleans.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that was the tenor of the times.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the governing group made a decision to, you know, essentially blackball New Orleans because of that. No, I know the meeting hasn't been there, but I've got the whole list of, you know, meeting sites and dates.
It's impressive.
And
It's impressive. And so.
Did you learn anything from these oil chemists?
I didn't learn. Well, yes, I did. I realized they were doing quantitative work and that there were ways to make quantitative measurements
mm-hmm.
when you understood ionization efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And you could make mixtures and do those sorts of things. And while you would say, now it's pretty simple
mm-hmm.
chemistry, it was for those guys, it was gold.
Mm, yeah.
And they had to deal with awful things like fragmentation.
Yeah, all those hydrocarbon molecules broke
up. They're branched.
You know.
So you can see where they came from when electrospray hit the world. Whoa. They said, oh, our problems have just gone away. The biggest problems have just gone away.
Yeah.
And they did. They had gone away. I don't know where they were with fast atom bombardment. They were in it, but not.
Yeah, so much of the stuff they dealt with was non-polar.
Yeah.
So you didn't.
You know,
I mean,
don't
Fab didn't help
them
a lot. Fab didn't do too much for them.
That's right. But once again, there were signs that better times were coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that sign that better times were coming was a flag starting to be carried by the biological people, who said, "Whoa, we're really solving problems.
Mm-hmm.
We can solve unusual problems,
mm-hmm.
groundbreaking problems, you know, with these methods, and we're going to take the ball and run with it." And that became then a section of ASTM E14,
mm-hmm.
and a very healthy one, rapidly growing to the point now where I think it has squeezed out everything.
Well, yeah, the focus of the conference has always been kind of fluid. You know, I mean, I remember the period when environmental issues had a huge, you know, you'd go to the meeting and papers on environmental analyses would be pretty dominant. You know, they would take over a large section of. But my recollection is biologicals didn't really come home seriously until Electrospray and Maldi got on the scene.
Yeah. Then they were going to solve famous problems. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just.
Yeah. But you guys were in a kind of advance guard using solid probes and fab. So when did you actually use fab at MIT, or did you?
Never did. That came after. That came while I was in the Army.
Oh, okay.
Think. Wait a minute, no.
I've got some dates on fab, but I don't know. I don't have them.
No, it was never. It was a guy named Guy Arsenault. Remember him?
Okay, yeah.
He worked in Klaus's lab, and he was, I think, the first one to try fab in Klaus's place.
So, like, I've heard his name before. Was he like a lab tech person?
No, he was a super postdoc or something.
Oh, okay, super postdoc. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those things happen, but it's kind of early in the time frame of what we're doing to. Yeah, he was, I think he did a lot of stuff, with Klaus and pushing the limits of things.
But not a lot with Klaus's people.
Uh-huh.
He was an island.
He was his own shop.
To himself, and so, which is fine, I didn't worry about how that came to be.
Mm-hmm.
But he was working, he was the front man to do some of that stuff. I'm pretty sure that Fab was one of them.
Was he was some French Canadian, wasn't he?
Yes. And he left MIT to go to Quebec or someplace like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, Arsenault, okay, spelling it for me. Arsenault.
Yeah, I remember. I actually looked at some of his papers when we were doing some things, so the name's familiar to me for Arsenault.
Yeah. Yes.
So he was. He eventually he left Klaus's lab and went on to
in the 70s, I guess.
Okay.
According to this, yeah. So he went then and got a different kind of job in Canada. So
some of the fundamentals work probably was a little bit interesting to you guys, you as well, right? How these guys were approaching the. Understanding ionization efficiencies and so on, and using it for quantitation.
Yeah, to do things.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there was this business that I never gave much thought to about the dissociation chemistry of simple hydrocarbons. And it turned out that CH5+, that I had never heard of, became one of the most famous ions in analytical chemistry, because it was the reagent ion for chemical ionization for methane. It was the principal product of methane dissociation. The higher the pressure, the more CH5+ you have, and it was a powerful acid.
Mm-hmm.
It donated the proton to all kinds of things, making protonated molecules in the gas phase.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing that in a mass spectrometer, you're doing it in the right place. And that, of course, was Joe Franklin's.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys were doing those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being puzzled by the whole thing, but I have to sit back and look at what they're doing and think about this business about the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you go up in pressure, and some of these curves were going down,
mm-hmm.
others were going up. And it was a challenging, fascinating thing. And I don't know if Joe even understood what this stuff was.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Field did after a while, but I think they were happy investigating the fundamentals.
Sure.
And it wasn't until later that somebody said, "Hey, wait. These ions you're making can do many things.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at this."
Mm-hmm.
And so forth.
Well, that did help in the ionization of some polar compounds, or polar compounds that were somewhat polar, right?
The chemical ionization technique. Depends on, so the whole acidity scale was created.
Mm-hmm.
So you had then the mild acids like CH5+, and you had, that's a strong acid, and a mild acid would be NH4+.
Mm-hmm.
So the NH4 is reluctant to give up its proton to somebody mm-hmm. unless they were very basic.
Mm-hmm.
And the CH5 was promiscuous. It would mm-hmm. give protons away
to all kinds of things,
including the, you know. But it made everybody aware of this gas phase ranking. Once again, chemistry, real chemistry, was at the forefront and was understandable.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been worked out by a series of people who had no great interest in applications.
Mm-hmm.
But the applications people soon realized that these were... let's look at that paper again.
Yeah, what are these crazy guys?
What is going on here? And
I guess I don't know if Burnaby Munson ever told you about that first paper that they tried to publish in JAX. Got the one of the reviewers just essentially, you know, blasted as being total junk.
I remember this guy.
These guys are a bunch of petroleum chemists that don't know what they're doing. So
it's that's easy to understand. You're out on them.
They were way out.
Brand new story here, and are they trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes? And in my eyes. Says the.
Well, like you say, CH5+. What the heck is that?
What is it? What are we talking about here? And CH5 became famous.
Yeah.
Famous ion. Was the heart
so the meeting the, did give you some kind of mental intellectual agitation and get you to thinking about different ways.
People working on what I was working on at those meetings were far and few people.
Oh yeah,
and so
there aren't that many of them today, are there?
No, not well. No, a bit more. I had coffee with a few of them.
A bit more,
but at that time. It was slow going, and I developed a deep interest in nucleosides and their chemistry, what they're being used for, and how we can do things for structural work
mm-hmm.
with mass spectrometry, which made me less interested in following the horrible stories of carbohydrate fragmentation
mm-hmm.
and really some
mm-hmm.
Other things where there are very meritorious but complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I just never got excited about that. But there are a number of people, of course, who would follow those fields because they were new and scrape the initial information off the top and drive on.
I think there's a guy at Washington U, I think, that still does a lot of that stuff. Feng Shu, I think. Does a lot of that.
Feng Fu.
Yeah.
He was my graduate student.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I wasn't aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Well,
mm-hmm. Yeah, he's been at WashU for a long time.
Yeah. So I guess he's part of the facility. Does the facility exist?
Well, excuse me. The Mass Spec Research Resource still is in its umpteenth year. Just got renewed a couple of years ago for another 5-year lick, but they're cutting back the initial allocation of funds that were to be given has been reduced. There's been a reduction in staff as a result of that. So it's having
who's
a real.
Who's the PI? Who is the PI?
That's Mike Groth. It used to be that would run out of the medical school with Denny Beer and Bill
guys.
Sherman and those guys. And Mike was hired to come in and take that over.
Associating him with St. Louis is still alien to me.
He's kind of back in Nebraska.
Fame was what he did in Nebraska.
In Nebraska.
That's what got him, really.
Yeah. No, Mike's been at WashU probably for 20 years now. And so he's taken charge of that operation. He actually has, there's a wing in that's in the medical school, a part that's in the chemistry department at WashU, and so he's the head honcho.
Been there on a number of site visits.
And
it
sure.
was always a very interesting proposition, because whoever was PI, they were in the middle of great problems to solve. You know, fabulous people there.
Oh, yeah.
And so it wasn't they were just looking for something to do. There were things to do.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, so do you remember meeting Danny Beer?
Yeah, in Shanghai.
No, was it Shanghai or Chengdu?
No, it was in Shanghai.
Okay.
It was at the Peace Hotel.
That's right, in a restaurant.
And his son went to Alfred University.
I approached his wife and introduced myself. He was in the restroom. I said, are you with this guy? Are you his wife or something like that? Dennis Beer? She says, yes. I said, oh. Then he came out and we had a big reunion and so forth. I don't know where he is now.
So now, let's get back to our...
I was just pointing out here that my father went to Washington University Medical School. That's correct.
You went dead?
To St. Edward's, yes. He went to St. Edward's University for undergraduate work. And then
Washington University.
Was it St. Louis University?
Well, there's both of them have graduate school. So.
It may have been St. Louis.
Medical school.
I think it was St. Louis.
Yeah, I think it was because
of
Catholic.
Yeah, it's St. Louis University is the Catholic school, Jesuit school, I should say, rather than Catholic, in St. Louis. And WashU is the other. Of course, WashU is the big powerhouse university in St. Louis. But St. Louis is doing okay.
Yep.
They're doing okay.
Yep. So anyway, where are
so
we?
So you've completed your graduate work with Klaus? By this time, and you're kind of hooked on nucleosides and nucleotides, and you're ready to start your career, and so what are you going to do?
Well, the first thing I was going to do was something that was a little bodacious, and that was I applied for a NIH postdoctoral fellowship to go abroad. And those were pretty rare in those days, very rare. Those days, and I went to Paris, and that just was an interesting thing.
So this decision to do this was just, there weren't that many of these, you just decided
to
go? No,
I had heard, actually through Klaus, that there were interesting things going on at a lab at GIF-sur-Yvette.
Where's that?
CNRS, it's outside Paris.
Okay.
G-I-F hyphen S-U-R with a small s. Y-V-E-T-T-E, cat, Y-V-E-T-T-E.
Oh, wow.
And it became a hotbed of mass spectrometry, actually, at a time when it was struggling in Europe for relevance and so forth. So
who was the principal to get it going there? Who was the...
There was a natural products chemist named Edgar Lederer, L-A-D-E-R-E-R. And he was a well-known guy who knew how to get things done.
And Walter was there.
And Walter Vetter, our next... That's right. I'd forgotten that.
Walter.
Walter Vetter, V-E-T-T-E-R, was one of the Austrian postdocs that Klaus had imported to help get the ball rolling. So Walter ran the mass spectrometry lab in this... Institute, so Institute of Natural Products, whatever, you see it on my CV, it's a full name there. And so the idea was, in that case, I would kind of replace him, but we had sort of a showdown after I got there, and I wasn't interested in just standing around running samples for people.
Sure.
There were advantages to doing anything where I was. I mean, all kinds of things. But the idea of just doing this, you know, and they come in and say, is it done or isn't it done? Where is it?
Yeah.
So we had a we had Frank talk. Actually, the Frank talk was done by NIH. I went to see the NIH man at the embassy in Paris.
So they had somebody representing NIH at the French embassy.
That's right. Wow. The American embassy.
The American embassy.
Yeah. So he dealt, I guess, with NSF as well. So he said, yes, we know there are problems like this that exist there, and encouraged me to.
So they wanted a lab tech and
tough it out. That's right. They wanted a lab tech.
And you wanted
real science. Because I just came from a science laboratory where you worked on real problems.
Yeah. Well, was that part of the European scientific... I know, like in Germany, they had the habilitation, where you get your PhD degree and then you're kind of an indentured servant to some big wig dude for another 10 years before you actually get to do your own research. And that's,
yeah.
I mean, that's what... My understanding, that's why Klaus, you know, after he'd experienced what was going on in America, he says, oh, those Europeans, I'm going to, you know, pursue my career in the United States where I can be a scientist now.
French did something similar, but the Germans have it much more refined.
More refined. I like that.
It's a more refined system, and it works well for them. Mm-hmm. There's no question that people who finish the habilitation are really well-trained. Some of them are fantastic, right? Mm-hmm. But they have spent a lot of their career in chains.
Yeah.
And they started to know that.
Yeah. So you got that straightened out pretty early on that you weren't going to be a lab tech for this.
So I did work on some science problems there, and that's reflected in several papers in my
Was that a year,
CV.
A one-year appointment or a two-year?
It was 1 year, and when it came, when it was due to be renewed or something, I was getting antsy and had went to visit, there are two people who became famous at that time named Ragnar Rihaga and Einar Stenhagen in Sweden. And the two of them had become well known because of their work on fatty acid esters. They had spectra of everything and they understood a lot of things. It was quite an interesting story, and so I went up there to visit them.
This was in Stockholm, or
Stockholm.
Yes.
Yeah, they offered me a job, and it wasn't clear who that was going to be with. And it turned out that it was that I wanted to work with. Rihaga, he was the instrumentalist, and I thought I would learn more with him, and Stenhagen was the chemist and so forth, and I had met, what's his name, he got the Nobel Prize, work on prostaglandins, which was Sune Bergstrom, B-E-R-G-S-T-R-O-M-S-U-N-E, Sune Bergstrom. And he encouraged me to go work with Stenhagen. But what happened was, so I went to talk to the NIH people about this conundrum. And they agreed that I could switch, that they would bankroll another year in Sweden. I thought, go.
Yeah.
This is not, it's just an expansive thing to do. And so we actually, I don't know if we got started on that or not, I went and visited those guys. And
that was in January or so.
Yeah, I went to Stockholm in January, February.
That wasn't a good time.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know what cold was.
Yeah, right.
People go outside, they open the door and run. That was news to me that you could exist, and they did very well. So I was impressed by that. But anyway, in the midst of all this, I became aware, or someone had tipped someone to write a letter to me about a position that was going to was opening up at Baylor College of Medicine in a laboratory called the Institute for Lipid Research. The director was Evan Horning. E-V-A-N, you've met him before.
Yeah.
H-O-R-N. Evan C. Horning, and his wife, Marjorie. M-A-R-J. J-O-R-I-E. And he says, you know, we're about to get into mass spectrometry, and we've got the money, we've got funds for an instrument. What did they get? They had a, have a CH5 or something. But they then, he was friends with Stenhagen in Sweden, and they then immediately found out that there was an instrument that was going to be produced by LKB. A 60-degree sector instrument. And they convinced that was the way to go. And then they did that. Where the CH5 was in that, I don't remember. I would have to ask somebody who knows, and I don't know who that would be.
I was just curious. You said you went to Stockholm to visit the lab that Rahagi and Stenhagen were at.
They had separate labs.
Okay, were they both doing mass spectrometry or just Rahagi?
Well, they were both doing mass spectrometry. But Rahagi was the guy who made the instrument work.
And he was using what kind of instrument then?
Oh gosh, he was using a large homemade sector instrument that was, you know, marvelous spectra and so forth and so on. But, and he didn't care much about the chemistry, but Stenhagen did.
Okay.
And so there were papers coming out, joint papers, lots of joint papers. And they were such that, that Stenhagen was starting to interpret the spectra.
Okay.
So wait a minute, I'm missing part of the picture here, because one of them, Rahagi was in Stockholm. Stenhagen was not in Stockholm. Stenhagen was in the boonies, on the other coast.
They had a, was it part of the ETH, or was that in somewhere?
No. He was on another coast, the other side of Sweden. And so it would, there was a question there, was if I went and if I moved there, which one would I work with and where would I live? And I thought it was a bad idea to try and do both. But it was never quite resolved when I got wind of the job. It was opening up at Baylor College of Medicine.
So you...
So I abandoned the Swedish plan.
You
before it started.
Yeah.
We went there,
but we didn't...
We were there for about 6 weeks from Mother Day took Lydia.
Was that a time?
About 3 months.
Did that fellowship begin? I think it began, actually.
Yeah. August.
I think it had begun.
September, we came home in October.
So you actually started?
I think that's right.
So it worked?
It didn't get anywhere. I mean, this few weeks.
About 6 weeks.
6 weeks, and that was in Stockholm.
Okay.
Karolinska
Institute.
And then you decided that it was too cold. No, you wanted to go to, you wanted to take up the opportunity at Baylor.
Baylor College of Medicine.
Before Cass's.
Now, it's not, no relationship to Baylor University. At that time, there was a tether between the two. But the tether was then cut while I was there, and they're not related.
So that's interesting. Is it, but it's still called Baylor College of Medicine?
Yeah, and it's one of the few freestanding medical schools in the country that has no university affiliation.
That's weird.
Yeah, but they found out they could do graduate work. Students could do graduate work and take courses at Rice.
Okay.
Rice is literally across the street.
Sure.
And has. Some very good people.
So we're talking about Houston then as a, Baylor, okay, Houston, Baylor's in Houston, Baylor College of Medicine.
Is in Houston, that's right. And Texas Medical
Center. Yeah, Baylor University is in Waco, isn't it? Okay, that makes sense.
Famous for other.
Yeah, well, you got Rice as no slouch of a school, so.
Yeah, and that's before the buckyball phenomenon, right, which must have.
Yeah, one of my sons went to Rice, undergraduate.
Must have lit him up. No, it's very, it's a rigorous school.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a very nice place. He had a fun time there. And did
used to be a time when I was in high school, they had no tuition.
Yeah. A good friend of my wife's husband went undergraduate there, tuition free. and then went on to medical school. But I mean, this was, he would have gone through there in the 40s, I heard, 50s, mm-hmm. late 40s, early 50s.
Rice Institute.
Yeah.
It was, and then Rice University. And I guess someday, one day, someone opened their eyes and said, whoa, we're really handing out a lot of education here.
But my understanding is the guy in his will specified that there was not to be any charges for this.
This is true. And also no women, wasn't that the thing, Kate?
Could have been.
I don't know. My friend was in 56 and she went.
No women and no tuition. I remember, you're right.
That must have been very early.
They broke the will. And it was a big deal. There were all kinds of things about, well, what? We're going to close the doors? We're going broke.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Your Honor?
Yeah.
I don't think it was ever all female. A&M was, of course.
Not all female, all male.
I mean all male. I don't think it ever was. Because there was a, yeah, I just don't think it was.
We can find out on the way.
Yeah.
History of Rice.
Yeah.
Rice Institute.
I remember when Brian was there, he was in St. Richardson College, and he had 12 floors of dorm rooms, but 6 elevator stops. So the elevator stopped at a half floor in between two, the idea being that supposedly the will had specified no building would be over 6 stories high. So they had another way to get around that, the first at Richardson College. So he was in that one where he only had 6 stops for the elevator, but at each stop he had a choice of going up to one floor or down to one floor.
Right. Yeah.
So, you are now in Houston at Baylor College of Medicine and working with Evan and Marjorie Horning.
Well, I was working in there, in that institute, and we were there 10 years. I was there 10 years. And rose to the rank of professor, full professor there. But I never published a paper with Evan Horning,
mm-hmm.
which is strange because he was very prolific.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have welcomed it, but I just wasn't interested, and I had these other strange interests, which were not biopharmaceutical anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, but
so what was his?
I think his game was there that my work was going sufficiently well that I was an asset to the program,
mm-hmm.
that, i.e., raising money.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there for all that time and helped him raise money, got him mass spectrometers, and many things evolved from this.
So you were going to NIH for these funds?
He did.
Oh, so he did?
I never did.
Okay. So
I never did.
But he was using your work, the results of your work.
Oh, in part, yeah. Plus his. He was a prodigious.
Oh, yeah. But NIH was the primary funding.
Yeah, for absolutely. Other funds he would take advantage of. And he did. He was running a pretty good lab there based just on the NIH work. He had money from other sources, but I think NIH was the main one. And do you like a cup of coffee?
Coffee would be great. Oh, with a little bit of sugar.
It's not made.
That's all right. Okay. We're not in a
big rush. That's your coffee, Jim. Jim drinks very strong coffee.
We can dilute it.
Okay.
I can dilute it. I don't know how dilute you want it, but you better come taste it.
Oh, okay.
It's very strong. And I make it half what it's for my kids and so forth, and they taste it and say, holy smoke! This is out of bounds. Out of bounds.
Oh, great.
That's good to know.
Bat City Beans.
I
probably 118 hours of time.